We'll call the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee to order. We have five, I think it's fair to say, pretty very important bills on today's agenda. The first one we'll hear from number one on the agenda is Senate File 2818, Senator Anderson's Green Solutions Act of 2008. Welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I appreciate your giving this bill some more time today. The bill, do you have a new engrossment since we deleted that first Section 2?
Okay. Is it Section 2 that Senator Bach took out?
Yeah, I presume you. So I just want to remind members that if you look at the bill, Senate File 2818, Section 2 is no longer in the bill. So let me just explain what is in the bill. Section 3 essentially requires the governor's staff and the commissioner of commerce and PCA to report back to the legislature on what's happened with the development of a model rule for the Midwest Greenhouse Gas Agreement. We talked about, I think we went through this in some detail in the last committee about the governor's signing of the Midwest Regional Greenhouse Gas Agreement with five other states and the province of Manitoba, and their intention to put together a regional cap-and-trade program and to develop a model rule between now and November of 2008. And that the purpose of this bill is to at least lay some groundwork for the legislative involvement in that process so that we can be kept as informed as possible about that negotiation as it goes forward and the development of that model rule as we move forward, even though obviously it's something that is done at a governor-to-governor level, that negotiation. And so Section 3 of the bill requires a report back to the legislature next February, or it says January, we're going to change that to February, of the status of the model rule that's been negotiated and of the results of the economic impact cost and benefit studies that are laid out in the bill. The information that's been put together as a result of those studies will be presented to us next year. And so the bill essentially, it creates a group of it states that six legislators will be appointed to be a group that will follow this process, to be observers to the process, and to offer advice to it. It states clearly that a cap and trade will not take effect until it is passed into law by the legislature at whatever date that occurs in the future. And then it sets forth the studies that we're asking for to really delve into the costs and benefits of a regional cap and trade system for Minnesota, for our consumers, for our businesses, and for our entire economy, and for our environment and health. So what we have is an amendment that's been worked on over the last few days, over the weekend, between Mr. Robertson from the Chamber and Mr. Grant from the Isaac Walton League have worked hard to try to find common ground on what the study should cover. And so there is an A16 amendment that would reflect what's been agreed to, which I also support. So maybe we could pass out that amendment and then I could talk about what's in there. And if I don't know if they want to speak to it or not, but I can explain it. It's up to you.
Well, if did you say you have agreement with some of the concerned folks on this A16?
Yes, and, Mr. Chair.
I wouldn't mind hearing from them or have them say on the record that they've worked on this and an agreement. You could start explaining the amendment if you'd like.
Sure.
Senator Anderson on the A16 amendment.
It changes the reporting back date to next February. It includes this committee and the committees that need to get a report back. And essentially, the rest of the amendment speaks to the details of the cost-benefit studies that will be done. And the Chamber had some concerns representing some other stakeholders about how these studies would be done. So what we've done, and I think some good improvements have been made in this, to lay out the economic costs and benefits, including environmental and public health benefits, of the proposed regional cap and trade to businesses, to families and family income, and to particular workers, businesses, and consumers as to how they could be impacted by this, and to look at various mechanisms for trying to protect jobs in energy-intensive industries, an analysis of investments that would be made to bring more energy savings and energy efficiency to homes and businesses and what the benefits would be of this investment, as well as a close look at what the costs would be to businesses and consumers of moving forward with a system like this. So it's really intended to be a cost-benefit analysis. And then the second major study is listed under Section 3 as Potential Cap-and-Trade Revenue Study. And this would look at if there is any revenue, without determining whether there will or won't be revenue or how much, it would look at if there is revenue coming in from selling allowances or from a cap-and-trade system, however it's set up, how that could be used and what would be the best way of using it, what gains could be made in terms of energy efficiency and helping target individual businesses and benefits to the workforce, et cetera. So the studies lay out those issues. And we also have another small piece, which was in my original bill related to governance, and we suggest that we're going to ask the University of Minnesota to look at governance. If there is some revenue that comes from a cap-and-trade program, we need to be really careful about how that revenue is administered, and that's what the governance study would look at. So we're proposing the University of Minnesota could help with that discussion. But the main studies are the cost and benefit studies, and the suggestion was made that that be done as part of the Midwest Governors Association work that is already underway, because the MGA will be doing an analysis, working with some expert consultants of costs and benefits of a cap and trade. And so we're just going to ask that this appropriation go directly to the Midwest Governors Association and there, so that they can use those consultants to do the study at the same time to focus on specific Minnesota impacts. So we could get what we're looking for, we could get the information we're looking for, but do it in conjunction with the MGA process. So I think it's a really good way to go about it.
Okay, Mr. Robertson, did you?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to say that I support the amendment, and it was something that Bill Grant and I and Edward Garvey worked on over part of last week and over the weekend. On Thursday and Friday, we were in Detroit for the first meeting of the Midwest Governors Association Working Group on Cap and Trade, and as Senator Anderson said, we really would like to work out a situation where these economic studies are done by the same consultants that are doing the work for the Midwest Governors Association. There are three significant consultants that are working on that, and we've started having conversations with some of those folks on how this might occur. And so this amendment is consistent with that, and much of the language in the amendment is language that was in Senator Anderson's original bill. We've just split it out into the economic study and then the revenue study, and so I think this will make everything work.
Okay. Discussion on the A16 amendment. Anybody?
Mr. Chairman, this is essentially several changes were made from this in the original Bach amendment that he had from last week.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, there's two basic studies. I noticed the one you've got a dollar amount of $400,000, the first study. Is that correct? The cost benefit?
No. No, we took out the number in the amendment.
Line 2.2?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think that was supposed to be blank, and we needed some more discussion about how to divide up the money.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the discussion in the last few days was to leave the numbers blank. That $400,000 should have been taken out and left blank, and then we will work on those numbers in Senator Anderson's Finance Committee.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, that would be on page 2, line 2, to strike $400,000 and just leave that a blank, and I would ask if the committee does pass this amendment to incorporate that into it as well. And this bill is scheduled for my committee tomorrow for the Finance Committee, although it's going to take a little more time to get this information, we may bring it back next week.
Do you want to, Senator Koch, did you want to move that?
Well, that's fine, Senator Metzen. I'll move that, but I had kind of further questions on that.
I think we could straighten that out, though, on the amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, prevails. Senator Koch, further discussion on the amendment?
So my question for, on the 2.2, the blank appropriation now, that would be assessed under Section 216B. Is that to the utilities? Is that where you're going to find that money, Senator Anderson? And then what about the second? We've got just a blank appropriation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, yes, that same. Would also be the same assessment under 216B.62 at the bottom of page 3. You'll see that.
What are we doing?
I'm not sure about the governance study.
Yeah,
that's included.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone in the audience wish to speak in opposition to the A16 amendment as amended?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I know in the last time you were here, we took out all these should-do things in the bill. Are they now shells? Are they now shall-do?
Chair, Senator Tomasoni, my original bill, they were shall. Then I amended it to make them, we like these ideas, and then you took them out completely. So now they're gone.
Now they're in the next
bill. So they're neither shall nor may.
And so what is the difference between the shoulds and the shells in your new amendment now?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, this is all part of a study. All that is study language. And there, again, the bill, it specifies in some great detail what needs to be studied to determine the costs and benefits of a regional cap and trade in a Minnesota-specific way. The bill also makes it clear that a future cap-and-trade program in Minnesota would have to be approved by the legislature before it could take effect. And then it also and requires the governor or the Commerce and PCA to report back to the committees of the legislature on the results of these studies and on the results of the governor's negotiation. And then the last thing it does is it appoints 6 legislators to be kind of advisory or observers to this Midwest Governors Association process. So that's what's in the bill now. And it's really collecting information, Mr. Chair, and asking that the legislature continue to monitor this process because it's so important for our state and because we're going to be deeply involved in enacting this legislation in the future should model rule, should we decide to do that.
Now, this started out. Is this Senator Bach's amendment massaged? Is that
yes.
What we're doing? Mm-hmm. Senator Bach, are you were you part of the so-called fixing up of this amendment, or are you aware of what?
Mr. Chairman, I think I am. I'm sorry I'm late. If we're talking about the A16 amendment?
That's correct.
I just have a question. I guess if we put this on the bill, Senator Anderson, do you support the bill?
Well,
I mean, I realize it's weakened the bill significantly, but I just want to know if it's something you still support.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I would like this committee to pass this bill out, and I'd like to pass it on the Senate floor. Yes, I support this bill. I'm very, very disappointed that we're not making any substantive progress on a discussion of what a cap and trade should look like, because I think what we're doing is allowing the governor to decide that without any legislative input. And I think there should be legislative input, but it's obviously a very difficult discussion. So that piece, I'm disappointed that's not in the bill, but I still support the bill, and I would ask members to amend and move it forward, please. I think it would be helpful.
I think I can't speak for Senator Bach, but I might try. if this goes on, I think we're kind of hoping that you will say that this will, I mean, you get it tomorrow in your committee, right? So that
tomorrow or next week, yeah.
That's what I think the concern is, that we've reached some of these, or some of us think we've reached some of these compromises, and maybe they'll go away tomorrow or the next week or something in another committee. And maybe that's what I think we're really thinking. We might as well say what we're thinking. And
well, Mr.
so
Chair,
we'd like you to support, well, obviously what we do, but it's not always the case, and we can't dictate to any other committee. But that's what I think the concern is. So, is that kind of close, Senator Bach? All right. Any further?
Well, Mr. Chair, just remember that Senator Pretner Solon's committee passed this bill in a very different form, and they supported that version. So that's okay. Unfortunately the way the process things change
I
from committee to committee.
I understand.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
This is just a – I'm trying to find it in the study language, and I don't know if I've been able to find it, Senator Anderson. So is part of what the study is going to find out is what the effect of not having states like North Dakota and South Dakota and Nebraska as part of the Midwest region? Are they going to be studying that type of stuff so that we know that whether or not we're an island out here and –
Absolutely.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I think that's a really important question to ask, is whether it will put us at a disadvantage. And what we could do, you know, we need to look at the disadvantage, but we also need to look at if we can overcome that disadvantage, if there's enough benefits to be gained from this. And so it's really an analysis of the costs and benefits and what mechanisms we could use to try to make sure that industries are not adversely impacted by competition from outside the region. I mean, the same issue will occur if there's a national cap and trade that passes. And so we need to be proactive in looking at ways to respond to that. I mean, I know in California, for example, they're proposing, as they move forward on their cap and trade program, they're proposing putting kind of a fee on the carbon input of the carbon content of products that come into the state that are competing with products made in their state, so that out-of-state people won't have an unfair advantage over in-state producers of the same product. Now, I have no idea if that's something that we would ever do, but we need to look at the impact on our industry and on our jobs and see if there's, if the costs and benefits if the benefits outweigh the costs, or if there's ways that we can overcome those disadvantages or not. That's very much what this study is intended to get at.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, can you tell me the path or the movement of this legislative greenhouse gas accord advisory group? Where it started and how we ended up with just 6 legislature. Has it always been that?
Yeah.
Language?
Madam Chair, or I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen. Yeah, I'm trying to remember if this has been changed. I don't believe so. This is we didn't want it to be a huge group of people, so that's why I came up with 6 members, 3 from each side, from the House, 3 from the House, 3 from the Senate. And clearly, we want to be reflected of the party representation in the House and Senate. And this has gone through Senator Rest Committee, where they specifically made it clear that, this is how they like to do legislative appointments, but it was similar to what I already had in the bill, that the majority party would appoint 2 members from the Senate, and the minority party will appoint 1 member from the Senate.
Senator Rosen.
With the House.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson. Is this the same stakeholder group that we worked on in energy with the governors?
I think. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I think you're thinking of that Green Economy Transformation Task Force, which has like 18 or 20 members, and that took a lot of discussion.
You're probably not alone, Senator Rosen.
That's right.
No, don't.
We're going to keep a lot of legislators busy, Mr. Chair, over the summer.
Okay, we're discussing the A-16 amendment as amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Anderson, how does this differ from what we passed last year in regards to cap and trade?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, that's an excellent question. Last year we passed state goals that say that we are going, in this state, we are pledged to reduce our overall greenhouse gas emissions by a certain percent, 15% by 2015, 30% by 2025, and 80% by 2050. So we've already got that in law. We also made some statements, which I don't remember exactly what they said, but something like by 2009, we will have some kind of law in place that will limit greenhouse gas emissions. We stated that, but we didn't enact it. We didn't say exactly what it will look like. So we haven't made the step to create a cap and trade program in Minnesota. That is not part of our law yet.
Mr. Chairman, is
Senator Tomasoni,
Mr. Fuller, do you know what the difference is?
Senator,
between this
Mr.
one,
Mr. Fuller, do you know what the differences are?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I think I noticed in my packet a copy of the 2007 law, and I believe it was Senator Sheeran and Senator Cook in the Environment and Energy Committee who discussed the regional activities and whether or not we'd have a cap and trade. So if you look at that, what you'll see is there's really three parts of the old law, which is 216H02. Subdivision 2 talks about a climate change action plan, which the Commissioner of Commerce was to bring back this winter. I don't believe they did that. And then in Subdivision 5, you'll see it refers to specific plan requirements. That's referring to that action plan. And this is where Senator Cook, as I recall, had insisted on putting the word how. So if you read that, the plan must be, talks about cap and trade. The plan from the commissioner, which we haven't gotten, must determine the feasibility, assess the costs and benefits, and recommend how the state could adopt a regulatory system that imposes a cap on the aggregate air pollutants emitting emissions of a group of sources. You can requiring those subject to the cap to own an allowance for each ton of the air pollution emitted and allows for market-based trading of those allowances. The evaluation must contain an analysis of the state implementing a cap-and-trade system alone in coordination with other states and as a requirement of federal law applying to all states. So that's – and then if you go on to the – and I don't – I think the MCAG, it's called, did look at it and couldn't come up with a conclusion. They thought it needed further analysis, as I recall. And if you turn the page, you'll see this is probably the most pertinent with respect to the regional activities. The state must, to the extent possible, with other states in the Midwest region, develop and implement a regional approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions from activities in the region, including consulting on a regional cap and trade system. The Commissioner of Commerce shall coordinate Minnesota's regional activities under this subdivision and report to the Legislative Committee of the Senate House
forward with regional, not state.
The jurisdiction. By February 1st, 2008, February 1st, 2009, on the progress made. I don't think we got that report. We might have in part. And then you'll see what to look at. Number one, in particular, the commissioner should determine whether other states are interested in establishing and cooperating in this system. So that's where we left it last year, and I suppose it's up to you to determine how the bill before us relates to this.
And, Mr. Chair, the only thing I would add to that is that the MCAG, the Governor's Climate Change Advisory Group, did recommend a cap and trade. They I think, supported a national one and a regional one, I guess.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Anderson, does the bill before us nullify what was in the bill last year?
No, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
No, it doesn't nullify anything. It just, like I said, it's a study. And it appoints some legislators to track what the governor is doing. Okay. That's basically what it says. The only thing it says that's really shall language is that a cap and trade does not take effect in Minnesota until we pass a law saying it takes effect in the future.
Senator Koch.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, and I'm so glad Senator Tomasoni asked the question, because my understanding of last year's legislation was that they were going to look at all aspects, not just about how to implement it, but the cost-benefit analysis. I mean, I was expecting to get some numbers back from them on what this will cost, or what is it going to cost our business, what is it going to cost our consumers. I think there's no – I don't even think that there's debate that this is going to cost people money. Our energy bills are going to go up with cap and trade. You have a low supply, you have a high demand, you have a and what happens? The price goes up. There's really no question, but I thought this group was going to look into it. So now we're going to spend more money, $400,000, $500,000, I don't know, throw it on the pile to do yet two more studies. And I appreciate what you're trying to do here, Senator Anderson. I appreciate what Senator Bach and Senator Tomasoni had to say on these, but I don't understand why we continue to need to have these different groups, different task force, nobody can keep track, all these different studies that don't seem to come back with some of the answers that we've already tasked them with getting for us. And I, so I mean, how am I supposed to have any faith that this is going to bring back? That we're just going to, you know, we fail to get the reports that we request. We don't get, you know, I don't know. So we spend more money. It's frustrating. Thank
you. Robertson, did you have a...
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I identified myself earlier. Mike Robertson, representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Having served as a member of the MCAG group, there was a lot of frustration. There were numbers that were developed, but the cost numbers were, quote, societal costs. They developed a cost figure that didn't tell us what was the cost for the different major sectors in the manufacturing economy, what was the cost to the consumers who were buying transportation fuels, what were the other costs, and that's the kind of thing that we need to really do a good assessment of this. And that's the study that will be conducted under this bill.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Koch, I mean, Mr. Robertson is right. The MCAG they studied the costs quite a bit, and they actually concluded that if we did a cap and trade, it would actually save Minnesota $9 billion, just so you know. Mr. Robertson might disagree with that conclusion or with some of the assumptions that were made, but it's primarily based on the energy savings that this program would drive, which would save everyone a lot of money if you use a lot less energy. But I think we all agree, or myself and Mr. Robertson agree, we need to drill down more into those numbers and really figure out the specific impacts on Minnesota businesses, Minnesota consumers, and how you can... And the specific benefits and how you can respond to those. What are some different ways to approach it that would be advantageous for Minnesota?
Diane Schmidt, would you like to visit with us before we adopt this amendment, if we adopt this amendment? You listed as an opponent. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Diane Schmidt. I represent Flint Hills Resources, and we produce a lot of transportation fuels for the state of Minnesota. As it relates to opposition of the amendment, I wouldn't per se oppose the amendment right now. I think in many respects, it's what we've been asking for, which is that we really need to understand what we're doing here. What I wanted to do today, though, is put a little context on the issue and why our company and why other companies have felt so strongly about having the studies and making sure that before we institute a cap and trade, that everybody understands what we're doing. And that's what I would like to just visit with you today about. I won't give my whole testimony, although I have it, and I also have a recent study that came out this last week, if anybody would like to pass those out. First of all, Flint Hills has invested about $1 billion over the last 5 years in capital improvement projects in the state of Minnesota. And so we have added a lot of jobs. We've done a lot to work with the economy of the state of Minnesota. And some of the reasons we want to talk about this cap and trade proposal is what impact it could have on our business and other businesses in the future if we don't carefully assess and look at the way which it's implemented. For example, in our line of business, transportation fuels, we don't have a lot of choices as far as our inputs. Crude oil is our input, so we don't have a lot of alternative energy sources that we can use to make gasoline. Additionally, the federal government recently passed ultra-low sulfur diesel rules, which actually required us to increase our CO2 emissions to get a different type of environmental impact. And that's good. It was good for the environment. But now, as we look at different processes or cap and trades, however it would be designed, and have to reduce those emissions, there's going to be a push-pull impact, which could reduce an investment. And I think right now a lot of people around the country, including businesses in Minnesota, are looking again at their investment profile based on, basically, as it's been discussed, this particular legislation wants to discourage the use of energy and increase the cost. We understand that. And I think something that's interesting that just came out last week was a National Association of Manufacturing study that is looking at cap and trade in Congress, which I understand is different. But I think if you look at those numbers, it's somewhat startling when you see when it talks in – it's on a sheet that is just the Minnesota sheet, and this wasn't in your packet. This just came out last week. And it talks about initial analysis and talking about what this could mean. And it said here that the price of gasoline in Minnesota – would increase between 73 and 140% by 2030. It also says that electricity prices would increase by 124 to 153%. And it basically said Minnesota residents would pay between 109 and 153% more for natural gas by 2030. Now, once again, this isn't legislation that is passed. There's going to be quite a debate in Congress. But as we look at all of these various proposals, whether it's a state-only, a regional, a national cap and trade, I think it's going to be significantly important that we understand that the goal is to be changing our economy, changing the way in which we use energy, and it will have some impacts to people in Minnesota. And I think, if anything, that has been my point, is that clearly we are environmentalists. Our company strongly believes in the environment. We have done some extensive measures, like reducing our emissions by 50% voluntarily. What we're talking about in these committee hearings is, what is the economic impact going to be? What are the trade-offs? And I think all we've been suggesting this session is that we look at those. And with the fact that Senator has put in these studies and has gotten the input of the legislators, which I think is extremely important, we hope that as this process moves forward with the governors in the Midwest, as well as at the legislature, that we just are certain about what we're doing to the economy, how it's going to affect jobs, how it's going to affect the kinds of prices we're paying for fuel, what it's going to be paying for electricity. And with that, I won't go through all of my testimony because I know you have several bills today, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Senator Murphy first, and Senator Scoy.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman. $1 billion of investment over 5 years. How much of that was for environmental equipment to mitigate the environmental damage?
A large portion of it actually was, I think, $200 to $300 million. I'll have to get you the exact amount. Was for our ultra low sulfur diesel project, and that project was to reduce the sulfur in diesel fuel, the stuff that gives you the black smoke. Obviously, a good environmental purpose, but that was extremely expensive. We had a lot of contractors as well as our own employees that went and worked very diligently to get that project done. And we're very proud of the fact that we not only brought it in, but we brought all of the product, all the diesel on at the same time, even though the federal government would have let us phase it in. So we were actually able to get a better environmental impact quicker because we did it all at once.
And Mr. Chairman, what did you say the fuel cost for motorists was going to be by 2030? What was the percentage?
Once again, this isn't my study. I just happened to run across it this weekend. We've been hearing in all of these various committees, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, we've been hearing in a variety of committees that people have talked sort of generally about potential increases in the price of fuel and what impact that could have on in investment as well as jobs. And this particular study was brought to my attention at the end of last week, and this is a National Association of Manufacturers piece that was put together, and it says, I think the sheet I handed out said that gasoline would increase between 73 and 140% by 2030. Now, once again, we're all going to have to look at their assumptions and find out how they assumed these numbers, but clearly people are indicating that there's going to be fuel cost increases as a result of a cap-and-trade program.
So Mr. Chairman, so what that study says that sometime in the next 12, 14 years, it's going to go up between 73 and 140%. And, Mr. Chairman, I would just say that, you know, over the past 4 years, it's went up more than that, so I'm not too worried about it. But the question that I have is, how much is clean, breathable air worth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is obviously something for this committee and Congress to decide. And obviously, all we're trying to suggest is that the environment is extremely important, and so is the economy. Mm-hmm. And I think what Senators Anderson's bill will do now is take a look at that. So as you bring back and look at a cap-and-trade bill in the future, you'll be able to assess not only what the costs are, but consumers and others will understand why prices are going up. And they're going up, obviously, if you set policy for cap and trade, because there is a greater benefit to the public in that than there is the cost. And I think that's the decision that this body in Congress is going to have to make.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I I think I just heard overwhelming support for the bill.
Yep.
Everybody wants the same thing. So.
Senator Scoyer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Senator Murphy asked the question I was wondering about, the assumption that the 73% to 140% increase included normal inflation, and that's just due to the LW impact or not, but I guess we don't have that answer right now.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my understanding this was just the impact on the cap and trade program. Once again, this wasn't my study. It was just a study that I came across last week. I think the reason it's important that these economic studies are going to get done is so that we know what those numbers are. There's obviously a lot of reasons that energy prices go up. Right now, obviously, the cost of crude oil, supply, demand, electric energy prices have to do with the input costs, what kind of fuel you're using. So clearly, you have to differentiate what is going to be happening as a result of the normal market configuration because of increased fuel costs like crude oil, and then what is going to be the impact of changing the system in which that we operate. But cap and trade means you cap the emissions and then you trade them for a price and you raise a lot of money in the process. And as you do that, there's winners and there's losers. And I just think this economic study is important so you know who those economic winners and losers are and what, in fact, is causing the price increases. Is it the fact that people are making a lot of money off of it, or is it because there are actually input costs or things that have been changed in the government programs that increase those prices?
Senator Boniff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it sounds like, if I'm hearing correctly, that there is no opposition currently based on your new amendment to this bill. Is that correct?
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boniff, I guess I should first say Ms. Schmidt was suggesting that this cost-benefit analysis is a new idea, but it was in my original bill,
yeah,
actually.
Thank you.
And so that's something we wanted to do all along, and we've just sort of tweaked how it's done. I guess I can't speak for whether there's opposition. Every committee I've gone to, I've made substantial changes to the bill, and I certainly hope there's no opposition. I think everybody agrees we need the cost-benefit study, and I don't think anybody disagrees that legislature should play an active role in the process as we move forward, and that's really what the bill does.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Yeah, is there, I don't have anybody listed, but is there anybody that would like to speak in favor or against, actually on the amendment?
And Mr. Senator. Chair, just one, if I can just make one more comment, I don't want to prolong this, but I know Ms. Schmidt is very concerned about the price of fuel and what will happen to the petroleum industry, but I just want members to realize that it's not all gloom and doom, that, there's plenty of economic analyses that have been done about a cap-and-trade program that show a tremendous economic benefit that can be gained from this, that consumers can benefit. I mean, there was a national study that was done by the McKinsey consulting firm. This is one of the preeminent economic consultants in the world, that said that you could get at least half of the energy savings needed to reach our greenhouse gas reduction goals at a net multi-billion-dollar profit to those who invest in that energy savings. So there's really a lot of money to be made by doing this correctly, and so my concern has always been that we try to shape the rules in a way that will bring the most economic benefit to our state, to our consumers, to our industries. The ones that are willing to really try to work with this system, I think, will stand to benefit. And so if we do it correctly, it can really benefit our economy and our consumers, along with, saving our air and our water for future generations. So I don't think we need to be afraid of it. I think we need to figure out how to do it right. And that's the direction I'm trying to move us.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Anderson, again, back to this legislative advisory group that you have going here, that is still in the bill, right? It's not in the amendment, but it's in the bill.
It's in the bill, correct.
It serves in an advisory capacity to the governor's Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord stakeholder group and can request regular briefings from that group in addition to participating and offering advice in the meetings where regional negotiations take place.
For this one, sir.
So these legislators will be going down to these meetings where the
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, if there's legislators that are willing to do that, I think that would be healthy. for the process to have, you know, when the whole MCAG process went on, you know, the governor appointed 55 people who met and put hundreds of hours of work into the process of figuring out recommendations, unfortunately none of which are in front of us in the form of a bill, but hopefully we'll get some more out of that in the future. And some of us wanted to really track what was going on. I mean, this is really important for our state's future and for our state's economy. And so we don't really have a way to do that. And so I just want to make it a formal so that it's okay for a legislator to show up and sit in the room and listen to what's happening and to speak, you know, to consult with the stakeholders. The governor's appointed four people to really negotiate. In addition to his staff, there's four stakeholders that have been appointed to represent all of us in Minnesota to negotiate this regional plan. And I think it would be important for legislators to at least know what's going on and to be able to talk to those people and not just sort of have it dropped in our lap a year from now and say, here's what we came up with, hope you like it.
Mr. Chair.
Rosen.
Senator Anderson, so there's four in the stakeholder group and then you've got six from the legislative group. Are there other states that are going to be bringing this delegation down with them to negotiate?
Because I would assume there has to be some cooperation with the governor to make these meetings productive if not everybody is on the same page.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's really up to the governor. This is a governor's process. And so hopefully the governor will be willing to include us, but we can't force him to do that. I mean, I understand there's a separation of powers that goes on here. So we're going to make ourselves available, legislators available to participate. I don't know of any other states that are doing this. But, you know, that doesn't mean Minnesota shouldn't lead the way.
Okay, wait, that was a little off the amendment. But, Senator Bach, did you want to do the A16 amendment?
Has it been moved?
No.
I'll move the A16.
Okay, further discussion on the A16 amendment as? Did we amend that?
Yes. We amended the number.
As amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Now we're on the bill as amended. Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've expressed this to Senator Anderson, but I'm getting increasingly anxious, and it's not being helped any by what I see going on in the financial markets right now. Out east, and we all should be very worried about people's jobs. You know, and there's a cumulative impact to everything we do here. And, you know, if somebody's utility bill goes up $10, $15 because of some things we do here, you know what? People will get through it. But if their job goes away because of some of the cumulative things we do here, that's serious stuff. And I just think we all need to be aware of that. You know, I've got a plant up in my district that produces oriented strand board. We call it OSB. And it's not operating today. And all I can do for them is give them a 26-week unemployment extension. And maybe I can't even get them that at the end of the day. I don't know if it's going to ever reopen. And, you know, the 150 or 200 people that are in ancillary jobs that provide the raw materials for that plant, many of them have gone out of business and a whole lot of them aren't working. And their competition is not in China or in India. It's in Mississippi and it's in Georgia and it's in the Carolinas and Tennessee. And that's who the wood products industry competes with and who the paper industry competes with. It's not all overseas. So what we do here that is different than is done in other states, there is potentially an impact to Minnesota jobs and Minnesota families. You know, yesterday I noticed the diesel fuel in the little town I live in was $4.07. $4.07. And I don't know what's going on to cause that. I mean, it was 90-some cents higher than gasoline yesterday where I live. And I'm getting very, nervous. And, you know, our job isn't that hard here. You know, we're going to be here. You know, we all think cutting $1 billion out of the budget's a big deal. Ain't that big a deal. We'll get through that. We'll find a way to do that. But a year from now, you know, it's all projected to be $2 billion. And if what's going on out east continues, it might be a lot worse than that. And I think we all need to take pause at what's going on. The Federal Reserve is going to probably make a dramatic move tomorrow, probably a historic one in lowering interest rates, because I don't think they know what to do either. And historically, what they've been able to do with monetary policy has had some impact on the investment community, and it doesn't seem to be doing that. We're in very uncharted territory as a country. And I think studies are okay. I'm going to vote for this. But when you start coming to implement things, this is, I think, a very, very potentially have a lot of impacts on a whole lot of people. Things can get a lot worse than they are today. And I just want to express that we got to, and, you know, many of you have heard me give that speech, something similar to that before, but getting more and more nervous. We'll see what Wall Street does again today, but this really is uncharted territory that we're in. Senator Anderson, I support the studies, but I guess when it comes back from conference, if it's something more than that, I'm going to get up on the floor of the Senate and speak to send it back.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking a little earlier when I made a couple of remarks, too. Any further discussion on Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think some of what Senator Bach says is very wise, and that is that we ought to take pause. In fact, I've taken pause. Last year I voted for the energy bill, and Senator Anderson, I'll say I regretted it. Afterwards, I thought, well, you know, I'm told it's kind of a compromise, but I think some of the players probably, you know, felt a little under duress that something was going to get done. The political winds were blowing in a certain way. But I regret that vote, and the reason I do is because I've looked at this, I've delved into it more, I've looked at it more, and this is about energy rationing. We're on a path towards energy rationing. When you cap, that's limiting a supply. Trade is about doling out the ability for people to produce energy. Energy is the equivalent of economic development. And those on this committee who are concerned about economic development and jobs, and I know that there are, certainly should be listening to what Senator Bach is saying. And, you know, the notion about $9 billion in savings, that this is as economic benefits and benefit to consumers, I think that any benefit is going to come I don't think there is. I think that there's going to be so much cost up front that these benefits will never materialize. And I think that we ought to try to extricate ourselves from this path we are going down. And we need a free market in energy production. Energy production lifts people's standard of living. It extends our lives. It does all of that. And a lot of these, you know, I realize there's a larger policy debate waging, and it's the wrong direction to go. So I voted to put the amendment on there, but this is where I would differ from Senator Bach, is I think we should vote down this. I think we should do everything we can to extricate ourselves from the direction and the path we're going down, because it's going to lead to energy rationing and less economic development and less jobs.
Okay. Further discussion on the bill. Anybody care to,
Mr. Chairman, I would.
Senator Murphy,
I would move the bill as amended.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would be remiss if I just didn't remind Senator Gerlach that there won't be a standard of living if we continue down the same path that we've been on, because we know that free markets tend to pick the cheapest sources, and that's coal. And I don't think that that's appropriate in this day and age. Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 2818 as amended be recommended to pass.
Okay, on the motion, Senator.
To finance.
Does it have to go to, where's it go, to finance or your committee?
Finance.
To include the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Do we still need the resolution now, or put the bill moving, or
we're going to keep talking about that, I think.
Well,
if it would be, you know, I'd prefer it if I could come back and speak with you about that tomorrow and let you know how we're moving on that. I don't.
And take it up, it'll fail.
All right, we'll let that go.
Take it up, it'll fail.
Senator Rummel. Senate File 1858, does she?
I don't know.
Jim wouldn't call on me again.
That works for me. I think we've got about as much chance as we're going to have.
Senator Rummel, welcome to the committee, and we have before us Senate File 1858. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You know, last Christmas, when a number of the toys were being recalled left and right and being sent back to China, a tremendous amount of concern arose in our communities. Parents across this country and in the state were concerned about what were the safe toys and products they could buy for their children. And I don't know about you, but I remember following this story, and there was an article in at one point where it was featuring the fact that people were no longer going into their stores to buy children's toys because they didn't know if they were safe. Instead, they were either making their own toys or turning to handcrafted toys here in the country. Toys R Us paid attention to what happened last Christmas. And they have already decided to ban certain chemicals from any of the things they sell in their store. What's going on? I would suggest that the feds are not doing their job. And 11 states are looking to phase out toys containing toxic chemicals for children under the age of 3. Now, I'm talking about toys for children under the age of 3. This is not a huge, huge bill. Senate File 1858, called the Healthy Children's Product Bill, will protect Minnesota's children from toxic, hormone-disrupting chemicals. Again, it's a modest bill. It's targeted for those things that are necessary or useful to children under the age of 3. The bill calls for the phase-out of phthalates. This is a chemical used in plastics, and it makes those plastics soft. And it's found in such things as teething toys, baby bibs, and similar soft plastics. This is a hormone-disrupting chemical. It can lead to the feminization of the male reproductive tract, lower sperm count. It's linked to asthma and rhinitis.
Rhinitis.
Runny nose. The bill also phases out BPA, or bisphenol A. This is a chemical used in plastics to make them hard and is found in polycarbonates, such as baby bottles and sippy cups. In this case, the hormone disruption may lead to such things as the demasculization of males and the defeminization of females, prostate and breast cancer, diabetes and insulin resistance, miscarriages. Members of the committee, safer alternatives do exist for these products. I'm not talking about for these products. I'll just leave it there. We'll get into the details later. Today you are going to hear a good deal of conflicting science. And I would encourage you to understand that we can listen to science forever. Knowing what we know about synthetic estrogens, and we're going to hear probably more than you've ever wanted to hear, it is my question, and what this bill proposes, is do we want them in baby bottles? Do we want them in the toys and the things our children use? Okay. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce my first witness. Her name is Lindsay Dahl.
Madam Chair. He has a question from Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I heard somebody say hello on the phone. Do they know that we're here and that we hear them?
I believe so.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear us respond to them. Okay.
So, Ms. Dahl, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me here today, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm just going to walk us through the bill really quickly, and I'll be here to be able to field some questions. My name is Lindsay Dahl, and I am the coordinator for Healthy Legacy. We are a statewide public health coalition that is working to eliminate toxic chemicals from everyday products. We currently have 26 member organizations that range from the Minnesota Parent Teacher Association, the Minnesota Council of Churches, health affected groups. We're pretty much all across the board. And I'm just going to walk us through the bill really quick. And then I think I'll leave we have two scientific experts here that I'll leave to kind of address the science of bisphenol A and phthalates. So to begin, the definition section, Senator Rummel has worked closely with the Beverage Association and others to shape up the definitions in the way that that is comfortable for all parties. So we'll begin with Section 2. Section 2 is specifically addressing bisphenol A in children's products.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up.
Okay, I'll continue. Bisphenol A is, like Senator Rummel mentioned, it's a building block of polycarbonate plastic. It's specifically for the purview of this bill, focusing on sippy cups, baby bottles, and specifically the can linings for infant formula. Section 3 is looking at phthalates. There are six different types of phthalates that are addressed in this piece of legislation. And the phase-out date for both of them is currently January 1st, 2009. I would like to note that for
this is Fred Lumsall.
And we're in committee right now. If you could please hold.
Jesse, welcome.
If you'd like. When we get to your testimony, we'll call on you.
Okay.
Thank you. Please continue, Ms. Dahl.
Yes. I would like to note for both bisphenol A and phthalates, there are already safer alternatives on the market. Bisphenol A, for example, there's polyethylene, which is actually sometimes a cheaper baby bottle that are currently on the shelves at our local retailers today. I would also like to note that there are 11 other states that are working on phasing out bisphenol A right now. There's been overwhelming scientific consensus over the past 6 months to a year, and that's really what spurred the states moving forward on bisphenol A. And I'd also like to note that phthalates are banned in the European Union, which constitutes 27 countries, in addition to 14 other countries, including Argentina, Fiji, in Mexico. The date January 1st, 2009 was specifically chosen because phthalates were recently banned in the state of California, and that's the date that they chose to use. In addition to what Senator Rummel mentioned, January 1st is the date that Toys R Us is phasing phthalates out of their toys. So we're just trying to be consistent with what's already being done with the manufacturers. Section 4 is talking about replacement chemicals. So as we look forward to phase out these
dangerous... Excuse me, Ms. Dahl, we do not have the current engrossment, so we are making copies in case you're looking for Section 4. It's not in your current bill. So we'll be getting that, I understand.
Okay, great.
Just wanted to make a note of that. Thank you. Please continue.
Section 4 is looking at replacement chemicals. So as we move forward and look to phase out these toxic chemicals, we want to make sure that they're safe, so our replacements are safe. So this is language to make sure that happens. And like I mentioned before, there are already safer products on the shelves today. And then finally, Section 5, it's just permissive language as we move forward in looking at public health and environmental health in the state of Minnesota. We want to have the Pollution Control Agency be able to participate in an interstate clearinghouse. The clearinghouse doesn't exist yet, but in the future, if it does, it's just permissive language. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also have with me Dr. Willinga. Dr. Willinga?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is David Wallinga. I'm a homegrown expert. I'm a physician, graduated from the university here, and then went on to get a master's at Princeton University. I currently serve on the Board of Scientific Counselors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the National Center for Environmental Health, and have been on the EPA Science Advisory Board in the past. I'm going to talk just a little bit about what we know in terms of the science with respect to these two classes, phthalates and bisphenol A, and Dr. Von Saal on the phone is going to give more specifics about bisphenol A. There's a lot that we know and agree upon in terms of the science. One thing is that There's literally hundreds of studies now showing that these two classes of chemicals can disrupt hormones. They're known as endocrine or hormone disruptors. We know that the vast majority of the American public carries around levels of these two classes of chemicals in their bodies. About 95% of us have detectable bisphenol A. And in a study just a few weeks ago published in Pediatrics, looking at 169 infants, it was found that 80% had seven different phthalates detected in them. We agree in terms of the science, too, that there's potential concern for human health out of these exposures. Where there is some disagreement is how significant that concern is and what to do about it. And the latter is really not a scientific question. That's a policy question, which is why we're here today in front of you. Another thing we know is that among the people that are exposed, the most vulnerable might very well be the youngest of us, children and fetuses who are exposed because of their mother's exposure, and then very young infants. And why is that? Well, it's because, for one thing, little children have behaviors that you and I don't. They take things like this and they stick them in the mouth for minutes or hours a day. They crawl around on the floor where phthalates are also found and put their fingers in their mouth. And then it's also because they're still developing. And so their organs that depend on hormones that these chemicals may disrupt, those organs that are developing are still young, and their development can be thrown off course. So the brain development, for example, much of which takes place in the womb but then continues all the way through into adulthood, that requires hormones, as does reproductive system development, gonads, testicles, ovaries. All these require hormones. There's also agreement that even exposures to very low levels of these environmental chemicals can be concerning. Well, how do we know that? We know that because pharmaceuticals that we intentionally take, the effective dose for Cialis, which is like Viagra, is 30 parts per billion. The effective dose for some birth control pills is 30 parts per trillion. Okay, so when you hear that the exposures that we currently have to bisphenol A and phthalates are on the order of parts per billion, it's the same approximate level of exposure that we have to these pharmaceuticals that we want to be effective. We know that. We know that results in animal studies are often a useful signal for what may be happening in humans, and that's why when we have a new pharmaceutical and it goes through preclinical testing, they test it in animals to try and predict what the effects in people might be. And it's because animals have a lot of the same basic building blocks in their biology as do people. So, for example, in the rat brain, there's a phthalate called DEHP that's been shown to disrupt the effect of an enzyme that converts testosterone into estrogen. And that's important because when your brain's developing early in life, you actually need estrogen to masculinize your brain. So if you're a young male developing the womb, you need estrogen to develop into a male brain. Okay. Well, it turns out that this phthalate disrupts that transformation of testosterone into estrogen. Finally, in terms of phthalates, we've got decades worth of studies that add up to a picture of what happens from early exposure in pregnant animals to phthalates. And what's been identified is something called phthalate syndrome, which is a bunch of reproductive tract abnormalities and related effects, all of which depend on hormones. And what's really concerning is that now we've got human studies that show the same general picture in people. And I'm just going to mention three and then listen to Dr. Vamsal. A recent study in 2003 of women showed that those with greater phthalate exposure while pregnant in general had shorter pregnancies. and early, you know, early delivery is not a you want people to carry to term, okay? Another study in 2006, looking at three-month-old babies that were breastfeeding, found that the babies drinking the breast milk that had the higher levels of phthalates also tended to be those with the lowest level of testosterone. So, again, testosterone is a necessary hormone for normal development. And Shauna Swan and others in a study in 2005 actually looked at young boys that were born to women who had their phthalate levels tested, and they found that, in general, the higher the phthalates, the shorter the distance between those boys' anal openings and their genitalia, and this is a really important prognosticator for other reproductive problems. And in fact, a study just out today that I was reading in the web as I was waiting shows that that anogenital distance is actually very important. And I'm just going to end my remarks there, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Finally, I'd like to invite Dr. Fred Fumsal, who is curator professor, to be our witness in terms of bisphenol A. I realize that as I talk to many of the members of this committee, that that's where your larger questions are, is with the bisphenol A. And Dr. Fred Fumsal is the number one expert on bisphenol A. So if he can hear me, I hope he can begin his testimony.
Thank you. And Dr. Fumsal, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. How's the reception there?
We're just going to try to turn you up just a little bit. Could you try again?
All right. How am I coming through now?
Much better. Thank you very much, and welcome to our committee. And if you would just identify yourself for the record before you begin your testimony.
Yes. I'm Fred Wimsall, a professor of biology at the University of Missouri in Columbia, and I do research on bisphenol A and other estrogenic chemicals. And what I'd like to talk about to begin with, and I hope that some of these pictures have been handed out to the committee, is that the problem we have with polycarbonate is not that there's any residual bisphenol A unreacted when polycarbonate is made, but that the bond linking bisphenol A together in polycarbonate is broken as temperature increases or it's exposed to detergents or acidic kind of substances. The consequence of this is that as polycarbonate products age, due to repeated use, they release higher and higher amounts of bisphenol A. And if you look at the amount that a baby would get out of using a typical used baby bottle or polycarbonate bottle, then you find that this is in the low microgram per kilogram per day range, about 5 micrograms per kilogram. And this is considered 1,000 times lower than an effect dose that was predicted based on 1980s research to cause no effect whatsoever, and yet there are today literally dozens of studies, including many that we published in Nature and Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that show effects at these very low doses in animals. And what you see in human blood is that there are many studies now showing that the average amount of bisphenol A in human blood is in the 2-3-4 part per billion range. And while that amount may seem like a very small number to the average person, to the estrogen biologist that actually studies human breast cancer or prostate cancer cells, or these same types of cells in animals that have the same response mechanisms, it turns out that human and animal cells respond to bisphenol A as they to the natural hormone estradiol at about 1,000 times lower in the low part per trillion range than the amount that is actually present in human blood. This is really critical because one of the physicians of the American Chemistry Council and bisphenol A manufacturers is that bisphenol A is very rapidly metabolized, which means that it should be at very low levels in blood at relative to much higher levels being found in urine. And yet the amounts in blood and urine are, in fact, virtually identical. So the concern there is that the amount of bisphenol A that we're being exposed to is not being rapidly metabolized, which is the position of the chemical industry. Otherwise, we couldn't possibly have these levels that we have in present in our blood. And if you try to achieve the same amount as present in human blood in an animal study, you have to give them about 500 micrograms per kilogram per day, and that's already 10 times over the levels that were deemed beyond the acceptable daily intake level based on 1980s research. And so we have about 160 peer-reviewed publications by independent scientists showing adverse effects of bisphenol A. And one of the most important things that we now know is the molecular mechanisms that are causing these adverse effects are that bisphenol A is reprogramming genes in early development. And the consequence was shown very recently in a very elegant paper in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences by Dolanoy, in which they found that bisphenol A altered the programming of genes that controlled obesity and the development of diabetes, so that by the consequence of this was that the animals ended up obese with diabetes in adulthood. At these same very low doses we're talking about in human blood, you find that human prostate cancer is stimulated. And also, just a recent study produced by the main scientists at the National Institutes of Health, who in the reproductive toxicology lab showed uterine fibroids and polycystic ovaries, which of course is a huge problem for women, and these were caused by very low doses of bisphenol A exposed in neonatal mice. So one of the things people ask as a summary is, why should we be worried about a chemical that's been around a while? And the answer is, if you look at human health trends over the past 30 to 40 years, when bisphenol A has gone from very low levels to very over 7 billion pounds a year of manufacture, you see things in the human population like prostate cancer increase, breast cancer increase, sperm count decline, earlier sexual maturation in women, an increase in polycystic ovarian disease and uterine fibroids, increase in miscarriage, increase in obesity, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Every one of those is caused in animal studies by very low doses of bisphenol A within the range of human exposure. And while no one thinks that bisphenol A is the only basis for all of these adverse health trends, from a public health perspective, since bisphenol A causes all of those in animals, and all of these are adverse health trends that are occurring in people in the United States, there is certainly reason to eliminate this as a potential contributor to those adverse health trends. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you'd like to hold, if there are questions for Dr. Vamsal.
Yes, I do hope Dr. Vamsal will stay on the phone and listen to the entire committee hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'll be happy to do that.
Very good. Are there questions? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Dr. Vamsal. we've received some information that says it really isn't dangerous, that it's that bisphenol A has been shown to be safe, and I'm wondering why do we have this conflicting evidence, if you will?
Actually, what's really interesting is that I have published a series of papers talking in great depth about that purport to show that bisphenol A is safe. And one of those studies is actually cited in a recent FDA letter. It was both of the studies that the FDA is relying on in its assessment that bisphenol A is safe were funded by the American Chemistry Council. And one of those studies used a type of rat that was selectively bred over 1,000 generations and is not able to respond to estrogen that you would extract out of a month's supply of birth control pills. This animal would not respond to the estrogen in birth control pills. And it was selected for use by the American Chemistry Council in their study of bisphenol A. It's one of the primary studies that they base their conclusion of safety on. And so if you use an inappropriate animal model, then you can come up with an inappropriate conclusion.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Thank you, Dr. Fumsal. I'm wondering, is there anything that you know of that can be used or that is a viable substitute for this, particularly when it comes to lining the cans of infant formula, for example?
Yes, actually, what is interesting is that the Japanese public became aware of this about 10 years ago, and the Japanese can industry removed as the surface material bisphenol A in cans. We've recently completed an analysis of bisphenol A released from Japanese cans. It is not zero, it's 5% of the amount released from cans in the United States. And that great reduction in exposure to bisphenol A just from canned products was attributed by Japanese scientists in a published paper in Environmental Health Perspectives in 2003 for the reason they found a 50% drop in blood levels, college students, in their bisphenol A blood levels. So there are alternatives. We know that there are polyether sulfone, polyethylene, and polypropylene and glass bottles on the market in the United States and elsewhere right now. And in particular, the polyether sulfone was developed as a plastic that is very heat stable, and DuPont's own data show that at temperatures that completely dissolve polycarbonate, the polyether sulfone is completely stable.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? I think there are some other people here to testify as well. Senator Rumble, do you have anyone else to testify? Or?
No, Madam Chair, that's my set of witnesses. Mm-hmm.
Very good. I believe we have Dr. Robert Rankin, Marion Stanley, Dr. Harry Frisch, and Steve Henches here to testify as well on this bill. They'd like to come forward. And I do want to note to members that you should have the second engrossment now in front of you for this bill that includes all five sections and current language. If you would introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, absolutely. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marion Stanley. I am a senior director at the American Chemistry Council. I am a chemist, and I have managed the phthalate esters industry group for the last 18 years. What I'd like to do today is just take a few moments to tell you about phthalate esters. I know that this is a very complex subject and there's lots of information, and I'm just going to hit some highlights for you, and then I'll turn this over to my colleague, Dr. Fish, who actually has some human health data from Minnesota that I think you'll find very, very interesting. Just so that you know, phthalates look a lot like vegetable oil. It has about the same consistency, and our bodies metabolize them a lot like vegetable oil. Primarily, they're used as a softener for vinyl plastic, and then that's the products that you're dealing with in this bill. Phthalates have been very, very well studied by government agencies. So you've got complete reviews by the Consumer Product Safety Commission looking at the phthalate that is primarily used in toys. And interestingly, the phthalate that's primarily used in toys, which is the DINP, already meets the definition of safer alternative because it's not listed as an A, B, or C carcinogen by the U.S. EPA, nor is it considered a reproductive or developmental toxicant. And that's really what you're going to find in toys. Of this array, the other one you may find in children's products is DEHP. But you would find that in something like a pool liner, or you would find it in something like a slippy slide that kids use in the summertime. You might find it in a raincoat or in a shoe, or backpack pleather, that kind of item, but not in what kids really mouth. And what the CPSC did when they did their review of DINP in vinyl toys, they did probably the largest mouthing study of children. And they did find that, yes, children have things in their mouth all the time, but it's not preferential to a vinyl toy. They also did a worst-case analysis, which is interesting, because they discovered what kids do keep in their mouth the most are those little pacifiers. And those are silicone, so there's, you know, different plastic completely. They said, but let's make the assumption that this was vinyl. Let's make the assumption that it was plasticized with this DINP. They said, even if it were, kids still couldn't be exposed to a high enough level to cause harm. Now, they have also kept up with the literature, and they've looked at the literature, and they reaffirmed their findings last summer to a Senate committee in California. The other thing that I'd like to tell you about phthalates, Japan no longer considers DEHP as an endocrine disruptor. The European risk assessments have come out. The bans in Europe happened before the risk assessments took place. And after they came out, the determination was made that these compounds are safe for general use. The iconic use of DEHP is in medical devices. And so children are exposed there, and the FDA has said that the benefits of treatment far outweigh the risks. Another little fact that I'd just like to leave you with is that Canada has screened 22,000 chemicals. And of those, they came up with a list of 193 that they considered priority for further review, further immediate review. Not one of those is the phthalate that's in this bill. So I'm going to leave it there. Happy to answer any of your questions. Happy to be a resource for you and provide other information that you need. And I'll turn this over to my colleague, Dr. Fish.
Thank you, Dr. Fish, for being here today.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here. I'm coming from New York. My name is Harry Fish. I'm a professor of clinical urology at Columbia University. I'm a physician. I run the Male Reproductive Center in New York, which is a center that really treats couples that are trying to have children where there's a male problem. Believe it or not, men do have problems when they're trying to conceive, and this is what this is all about, what is going on with men's health. I just want to say that Dr. Von Saal said something that was really interesting, and it's really why I went into this field. I'm a clinician, but I also do a lot of research because people that come to see me ask me these questions all the time, and I will answer to you. I will tell you what I tell my patients. One of the questions was, why should we be worried? And Dr. Von Saal mentioned there are adverse health trends. And I have to tell you, when I first got into this, I was very concerned that there was a major trend in a declining sperm count. We had somebody mentioned, we had the pediatrician mention, I forget his name, I apologize. That, you know, there's the phthalate syndrome, which really means the declining sperm counts, increase in hypospadias rates, and other male genital abnormalities. Well, when I got involved with this over 10 years ago, there was a report of a decline in sperm counts, worldwide decline. And I was worried, but I figured, you know what, let me be the first one in the United States that shows a decline in sperm count. So I started investigating. And what I did was I really published the largest study on sperm counts in the United States over a 25-year period. By the way, these I thought were going to be a PowerPoint presentation. But if you go to this study population, I called the three oldest sperm banks in the country, New York. There was one in Minnesota, by the way. In Minnesota, you have the oldest sperm bank in the country. And they were the – I'm not trying to patronize you, but they were the nicest ones to deal with. And they gave me data from okay, I am patronizing. But really, they were nice. They were nice.
We appreciate that very much.
But they gave me data from 1970 to 1994, and this represents the largest data set around. And you know what surprised me? Was we didn't find a decline in sperm counts. I was very upset at the time. It made a lot of publicity, but it really concerned me. What we did find was a geographical difference in sperm counts, that in different regions of the country, you had different sperm count ranges. And what the original study said was that instead of really a decline in sperm counts, it was a geographical difference. That is, they looked at sperm counts from one region at one time compared it to a different region at another time. And if you look at this, I don't know if you could spot this, where we actually list the sperm counts. You know, you should ask yourself, why is there so much controversy? Well, this explains why there was. In the early studies of that original study, most of the sperm counts were from New York, which happened to have the largest sperm counts. And that's just not just because I did the study. That's what was happening. That study has been repeated. Sure enough, New York sperm counts are the highest for whatever reason. But when they compared it to different regions, they thought they had a decline in sperm counts, when in reality it was a geographical difference. They actually said it in their paper. Everybody agrees to this. Dr. Scott Kabak, who wrote the paper with Elizabeth Carlson, agreed to this, that there is a geographical difference in sperm counts, but there is no evidence of a worldwide decline in sperm counts. Certainly when we looked at New York, Minnesota, and California, no decline. There were other studies, and by the way, I published these, and you can go to my website, harryfish.com. I even have a website. You can get a lot of this information. All the papers are there. The New York Times looked this over. Gina Collada, who is really, I think, one of the best scientific reporters, are U.S. men less fertile? Latest research says no. That was in 1996. Since then, I have a paper in press that looks at all the studies from 1995 on. I could tell you of the sample size, there's table one and table two. 103,000 men were studied, showed no decline or increase, or they showed an increase. There was 9,000 men studied that showed a decline, 10-to-1 ratio on this. You do have a lot of conflicting information, but the overwhelming majority of the data shows there is no decline. But let me just move ahead. I could tell you right now, nobody's going to tell you there's a worldwide decline in sperm counts. The only study in Minnesota showed there's no decline at all. When it comes to hypospadias, now, a lot of people will tell you there was an increase in hypospadias. That was based on the CDC reports from years ago. It ended in 1993.
Excuse me, Doctor, if you could explain that term. We are a business committee, and we may not understand some of these.
Hypospadias or CDC?
That term, yes.
I'm sorry. By the way,
I don't quite understand.
Not only do I
come, maybe other members do not, but
not only do I come from New York, but I had a lot of coffee just before, just to keep
okay.
up.
You're
so I'm talking
very
fast.
Good job. You're doing a very
so I'm
good
trying
job.
To get all the information across. When we talk about the phthalate syndrome, we talk about that in animals and whether it really is happening in humans. And the phthalate syndrome is whether in animals they may see a decline in sperm counts, an increase in hypospadias rates. Now, hypospadias is an abnormal opening of the tip of the penis. So that's hypospadias. And that's kind of important for fertility. It's supposed to be at the very tippy top. If it's at the base or really at the shaft, that can cause major problems. A lot of people are saying that these phthalates are causing these abnormalities. So hypospadias is that one. Now, the hypospadias information is the same. When I saw this originally, this presentation, that hypospadias rates were increasing, I said, you know what, let me look at this. I was confused about sperm counts. I thought they were dropping. They were not. Let's look at hypospadias. In New York, we have the Congenital Malformations Registry for the New York State Department of Health. Charlotte Drusel, who runs it, is fantastic. She gave me the data from 1983 to 1996 of all babies born in New York State. Guess what? There was no increase in hypospadias. Now, because of this meeting, I got more data up to 2005, no increase in hypospadias over a 22-year period. Now, is that just New York State? No. March of Dimes in California did the study. There's a decline. If anything, there's no increase in hypospadias rates in California. Now, between New York and California, that's one out of six babies born. Washington State came out with the same thing. From 1987 to 2002, no increase in hypospadias. Well, what about Minnesota, since we're here? Well, you guys actually have, it's called the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm telling you this. You guys know this, right? There is the Minnesota Department of Health, and I just went on their website to get whatever information we possibly can, because we're here. What is the hypospadias rates going on here? And this is what this graph is. They had data in that data set from 1998 to 2006, and there was no increase in hypospadias. What was interesting, though, is that the rate of hypospadias from your data gathering, which is really the best way, this is what the United States is trying to do, get each state to get data on every child that's born, the rate was about 3.5 per 10,000 births. 3.5 for 10,000 births. That is one of the lowest hypospadias rates in this country. Now, I got to tell you, is it going up? Was it lower back 40 years ago? Well, I only found one study in the literature that looked at that, and it was the last page of your handout. This is really fascinating. It's a study of the incidence of hypospadias in Rochester, Minnesota, 1940 to 1970. And what they found, of the 13,000 births, there was no variation over that time period. There's no increase or decrease in hypospadias, but the rate, interestingly, was 82 cases per 10,000. Well, now, based on our data here, it was 3.6 per 10,000. Now, obviously, there could be ways of collecting data differently, but I have to tell you something. I have looked all over. I have not found anything that says male reproductive health is on a decline. And this is what I tell men who come to see me, couples, because the men don't come by themselves. It's always the wives, let's face it. I tell the wives and the men that there's no evidence of these chemicals in the environment that are causing problems. Certainly over the years, nothing has changed in that respect. What has changed is a lot of men and women are waiting longer to have children, and that's where we're seeing the increase in infertility treatments and options. But overall, there is no evidence in Minnesota or in the United States there's a decrease in sperm counts or a higher incidence of hypospadias rates as well. So what we see in animals should not be extrapolated, to humans, because it is just not right. It is just not happening. If phthalates have been in the environment for over 50 years, which it has, you would think there would be a major problem. I initially was upset. Now, I'm not upset because it is the reality. I was upset that I didn't find an increase because I figured, let me get on the bandwagon. But that is not the case. The truth matters. And taking these products out of what we have now may have unanticipated consequences, and that's something that I'm concerned about, because in the hospital, most of our products are made out of plastics and, of course, all the other things as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions? All right. Our next testifier, I believe we have a couple more people at the table who would like to speak.
I'll go next, I guess. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Robert Rankin. I am Manager of Regulatory and Technical Affairs at the International Formula Council. The IFC is an association of manufacturers and marketers of formulated nutrition products, including infant formulas and adult nutritionals. On behalf of the IFC, I thank you for the opportunity to appear today. IFC member companies are committed to providing infant formulas that are both safe and nutritious. Among its provisions, Senate File 1858 would prohibit manufacturers from offering for sale in the state of Minnesota children's products that contain bisphenol A or BPA and phthalates, including packaging used for infant formulas. We believe the current available scientific literature and evidence does not justify such a prohibition, and would unnecessarily restrict the choice of infant formulas currently available to Minnesota infants and moms. The safety of BPA is supported by many national and international regulatory agencies, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the European Food Safety Authority, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the Japanese National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology. Government and scientific bodies worldwide have reviewed the science of BPA and have concluded BPA is not a risk to human health. As Dr. Vamsal noted in a letter to a U.S. congressional committee dated February 25, 2008, FDA noted they had previously examined the safety of food contact articles, including can enamels of infant formula packaging. FDA, quote, believes that this level of exposure to adults and infants is safe. FDA noted that this conclusion is based on its most recently completed reviews of two pivotal multigenerational oral studies performed under applicable regulatory guidelines. FDA has compared the, quote, no observed effect levels of the data reviewed to the estimated daily intake values and considers that an adequate margin of exposure exists for the conclusion of reasonable certainty of no harm under the intended conditions of use. Recently, an independent expert panel used all relevant literature to perform a comprehensive risk assessment on BPA on behalf of the European Food Safety Authority and found appropriate evidence of safety to support a five-fold increase in the allowable level of BPA in food. The expert panel stated, quote, in its evaluation, the panel gave special attention to infants and children and noted that infants would need to consume hundreds of times the amount of BPA found in canned foods to approach any safety concerns. Based on these reviews, we believe provisions pertaining to BPA in Senate File 1858 are not supported by science and thus are unnecessary and should be removed from the bill. As many of you know now, BPA is used in food packaging to make epoxy can coatings, which are used to protect the ingredients and ensure the sterility of its contents. BPA is not an ingredient in infant formula. It is only present in trace amounts in some of the packaging of canned foods, such as infant formulas. Epoxy can coatings have been extensively studied and approved for use in direct contact with food by national and international regulatory bodies and have been used safely in food contact applications for over 50 years. The lining prevents the food or beverage from coming into contact with the metal, which without the lining could result in damage to both the container and its contents. For example, without the lining, elements in the metal could transfer into the food or beverage, and the potency of the nutrients in the food or beverage could be reduced, or rust could compromise the ability of the can to protect its contents. With regard to phthalates, U.S. infant formulas have been tested for phthalates and have been found in trace amounts to non-detectable levels. British health authorities advised that the concentration of phthalates in infant formula were unlikely to pose any health risks to infants fed these products, a view supported by a British independent toxicology committee. Further, a European assessment found exposure to phthalates from infant formula is even lower than from grains, dust, and human milk. The expert panel convened by the National Toxicology Program's Center for the Evaluation of Risks to Human Reproduction concluded that, quote, the levels of concern are minimal to negligible in most situations. As an industry, members of the IFC take all safety issues very seriously. Our research and development programs are targeted to produce the highest quality of infant formula products available. When new information becomes available on substances like BPA and phthalates, we support bringing the information forward through the accepted process of scientific peer review and evaluation. This helps ensure that it is evaluated with consideration to existing science and that policies are driven by sound science. In summary, consistent with current scientific consensus on the safety of BPA and phthalates, and to preserve Minnesota parents and caregivers' infant feeding options, we urge the Minnesota Senate Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs to remove language from Senate File 1858 prohibiting BPA and phthalates in infant formulas. On behalf of the International Formula Council, we appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
And are there questions from the committee? Yes,
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Sir, would you agree that there are equally effective, less alternatives to BPA that could be used? If we assume that we aren't scientists here and we can't really make up our minds, but we want to do the safe thing, can you go to another chemical that won't pose those risks for us?
Madam Chair and Mr. Senator, we don't currently have information on those alternatives. I assume that our manufacturers, our members, are looking at certain alternatives. However, at this stage, the process that would be undertaken to appropriately review these alternatives and get the needed approval to implement these products would be quite a long time. It would take quite a long time to conduct such a review. And right now, we don't have available data on those alternatives.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Sir, are you working on it?
Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, to my knowledge, I do not have data on whether or not our companies, our member companies, are working on that, although I do believe that they are constantly conducting research and studying the available possible alternatives.
Senator Latz.
Sir, I would assume if California has a ban that's going into effect January 2009, since it's like the seventh largest economic market in the world, that your members are looking for alternatives to stay in that market. Wouldn't that be fair to say?
Madam Chair and Senator Latz, I do suppose that would be safe to assume. Unfortunately, I apologize that I do not have that data with me. And to be honest with you, we haven't had the discussions with our members to attain that information. So, unfortunately, I do not have the available information to give to you right now.
Right. Okay, other questions? All right, we have one more person at the table.
Okay, great.
Mr. Henges.
Hi, my name is Rob Harriet. I'm with the Toy Industry Association, and I'd like to just spend a couple of minutes to discuss our perspective of the legislation that's pending before you. A brief statement on TIA. We're about 500 members. We represent the toy manufacturers, and I'll distinguish myself between some of the other folks who've testified in that we don't manufacture the chemicals. We use the chemicals. And so it's not in our financial interest in any way to make money on these chemicals. All we do is manufacture and sell toys. So when we look at these issues, we don't look at is this science or are these chemicals cheaper or are they more expensive? We only look at what's the safest, what's proven to be safe. So the way we approach this, again, we ask ourselves, is this the most proven safe product? And the question's been asked a few times today, are there safer alternatives? There's even been the very direct statement that there are safer alternatives, when in fact the reality is phthalates and the DIMP phthalate is the most proven safe product to be used in this application. There is nothing out there that is more proven to be safe than DIMP phthalate. And when you ask yourself, okay, what are the alternatives, or is there something safer, you really have to ask yourself three questions. First, is there the body of work that's been done on DIMP phthalate? And if you look at any of the alternatives, and there are alternatives out there, but the reality is we don't know their safety level. We don't know that they are as safe as DIMP. So we ask ourselves first, from a manufacturer standpoint, is there the body of work done on these alternatives? And the answer to any alternative you'll hear today is probably no. We ask ourselves a second question. Has the CPSC made a statement such as this when it's talking about DIMP in plastic toys? The CPSC says that consumers should have, quote, a high level of assurance that soft plastic products pose no risk to children. Does the CPSC make that statement about any other alternative? The answer is no. We then ask ourselves, because a few of our members are global, we ask ourselves, well, has the EU done any work on this? And we ask ourselves, has the EU made a statement, which it makes, about DIMP in plastic toys, and I quote, unlikely to pose a risk for consumers? Does the EU say that about any other alternative? The answer is no. So that's the way we look at it from manufacturers. If you can answer those questions in that same way about any other alternative from a manufacturer standpoint, we want to use the safest, best product out there. And in our opinion, we don't look at who pays for what study from the chemistry folks. We don't look whether or not an NGO is using some study for membership drive. We look at all the studies, and we assess them the best we can. In fact, we even went out and commissioned our own study of studies. We had Exponent do this on our behalf because they're smarter than we are sometimes. And the exponent study came back and said there is no evidence out there today to reverse any of the decisions that have been made on DI and phthalate. So that is an independent body that we've asked to do this. It's not the chemistry folks. It's not the NGO folks. But it's our own folks who go out and look at everybody's studies. And they've come back to us saying there's no reason to reverse our opinion of DI and P as it is today. So that's how we kind of come to our conclusions. Again, it's what we feel an unbiased approach to this. It's for the best interest of our products and the safety of the children to whom we sell our products. Kind of the other thing I'll mention, two things kind of in closing. The fastest way to make a national standard in the toy industry is to go through what we call the ASTM process. It's a consensus process that our industry, in fact, the Toy Industry Association has worked with for decades. It may be interesting for some to know that the Toy Industry Association is kind of the originator or the original push behind the very first toy safety standards in this country, and we've maintained that leadership status for decades. So we do that through what's called the ASTM process. It is a wide open, very inclusive consensus standards making process. And what I would suggest that if there is anybody who wanted to make a very quick regulation or standard on the toy industry, it would be to go through the ASTM process. We have, to my knowledge, never received a request from any of the proponents of this bill or other bills, as you've heard around the country, to go into the ASTM standard-making process to limit DIMP or bisphenol A in toys. My personal guess is that because if you do that, the science is laid out on the table, the deliberation is laid out on the table, and all the cards on the table, and you have engineers, you have scientists, you have, yes, you have industry, yes, you have NGOs, you have government folks who sit in but not necessarily participate. And there would have to be a true discernment of what the true evidence is. We haven't seen it. The last thing I would say is that there are no alternatives that are as proven to be safe. And I think you've heard scientists from both sides and our assessment independently. And if that's true, then I would ask very delicately, how is this legislation then in the interests of the children of Minnesota? I can't see it. And I'm the father of a four-month-old son, so a lot of the effects that happen to children are supposed to be to infant males. I actually feel kind of lucky that I'm in the position I'm in today because it's forced me, because I'm paid to do it, read all of this stuff and try and figure out what the right thing is. And as a parent of my little son, Benjamin, I think that our industry is on the side of right here and that we are using the best products in bisphenol A and we're using the best products in DI and phthalates for the toys, whether they be teethers or otherwise, for our children. I feel my son is protected and safe, and I feel that your children should feel the same way. And
thank you very much, Mr. Harriet. We have about 7 minutes left, and we did have some people from out of town on Senator Tomasoni's bill, so we would like to keep moving here in case we are able to take a vote. Senator Carlson?
I have a question. Is it Mr. Harris?
Senator Soy.
Harriet, like the author. Yep.
Mr. Harriet and Madam Chair, your Toy
Industry Association.
Industry Association. Who are the members?
We have, again, 500 members, and I always quiz folks, I won't do it here, to name more than four of them. But we do have those that are Mattel, Hasbro. We do have Lego. We have 400-something other members that you've probably never heard of. So,
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Harriet, have any of them replaced these materials?
You will see some folks who move into some of the alternatives, and in my position from an industry standpoint is to let them speak to why and how. From an industry standpoint, however, when we assess this, we cannot back up any alternative as vigorously as we can DIMP phthalates or bisphenol A because, again, there's nothing as proven safe. So as people are pushed through either a legislative process or PR pressures into something else, we don't know where those roads are going to lead us. We don't know what those alternatives, if there's going to be issues with them, health-wise or otherwise. So it's an unknown entity that we're being pushed towards in some cases.
Senator Carlson.
excuse me, Madam Chair and Mr. Harriet. Hasn't Mattel replaced all of these?
I think you see that some of the companies, and again, I let individual companies speak for themselves, you will see some companies moving into alternatives. Again, from the industry standpoint, there is nothing, regardless of whatever individual company may be doing, from the industry standpoint, there is nothing as proven safe.
And Senator Madam Carlson? Chair, second to final, do you think that Mattel is making an error here in replacing the phthalates that they've
again,
replaced?
Again, I haven't made any statement whatsoever whether Mattel is or is not replacing these products. That's for Mattel to talk to those issues. I can only come to you from an industry standpoint and tell you what our understanding are about these products.
Senator Scott, do you have any other questions? Senator Carlson?
It's two questions in one. One is that I guess what you're probably saying to me is that it seems like you disagree with Mattel. If Mattel has already replaced the phthalates with an alternative, but you're saying that there isn't an equivalent product that has been either proved safe or not as safe as this one.
Okay, I've made no statement. I'm sorry.
Okay, and I guess just one other statement I want to make is that the Consumer Product Safety Commission right now doesn't really have a very good record of credibility more recently. Now, in fact, I think we've even made some changes here in Minnesota about lead toys. There's been a lot of recalls, so I think Consumer Product Safety Commission is probably not a good one to rely on for good information.
First, let me go back to what you were saying. Mattel is one of our members. I've made no statement as to whether or not they are or not moving out of these products. That's for them to discuss with this committee. I mean, I have made no statement to that. Second, there have been a lot of recalls over the last year, none of which pertain to phthalates or bisphenol A. There's not one recall on the books regarding these products. Because there have been some lead recalls, actually, our industry has gone to Congress and asked for some new federal mandates on our industry because that's what we do. We are the leaders in toy safety. We have been for decades. We will be for decades to come. So, I don't know if there's another question in there somewhere that I failed to answer, but...
Thank you.
Okay.
To Senator Soy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rummel, you have picked quite an issue here, and you made quite a mouthful when you said we were going to hear some conflicting science on this issue. As you and the legislature and legislators deal with these complicated technical issues, a lot of times it takes us a little longer than just a month or two to get our head around it. And I want to tell you, in our home, we have removed plastics from the shelves that we're going to put in the microwave. But we've done that. But that's our home, and that's our personal choice, and we don't need to have accurate science for that. We can just do it. But these state bans, that's another matter. And, we really should figure out what these issues are and how we can resolve these highly technical scientific questions when we have experts on both sides with such obvious different opinions about this issue. And it's real hard to think that the state is going to pick one side or the other when we really don't know for sure which side is right. And like I said, at home I can do what I want. But here, with the state ban, I just can't be supportive of that until we have some better understanding or more definitive answer to what we have going on. And So I certainly appreciate your effort in this, and you did say words when you said conflicting science.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, is this on? Mm-hmm. Members?
It is.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. I'm not a scientist. I'm coming here as a senator responding to people in our community, in our state. Last Christmas, when people went to buy toys, they were very confused about what they could buy that would be safe for their children. They are very interested in that. They look to us to give them some guidance. As a result, last Christmas holiday, many toy stores, many vendors had a decline probably larger than the economy would have suggested. Toys R Us saw that. They responded to that. You're right. We can't decide the science here. Although Dr. Von Saal and others have told us that of all the studies done, 90% and those that are done by governmental units, non-industry units, have found these chemicals to be harmful in small amounts to small children. Remember, this bill is about children under the age of 3. Think of an infant. Think of a 3-year-old. The chemicals in very small amounts act like triggers. They turn things on and off in the brain. In those little developing bodies, these very minute amounts of chemicals are very powerful. And so what I'm asking you here today to think about, and some of the things that the, for example, the CPSC in their studies, they did not consider the additive impact. In some of the things that contain phthalates, the there may be very small and multiple different phthalates in those products, but the additive impact of that can be devastating. We don't know for sure, but they can be. The CPSC considered a liver toxicity. We're talking about toxicity to the reproductive system and the brain system. The European Union has banned all phthalates that are in this bill, and it has done so repeatedly. BASF is a chemical company that has stopped making DEHP in Europe. It produces a safer alternative, and they still produce the toxic chemical here in this country. In other words, BASF has decided, in order to maintain its market in Europe, it has produced an alternative chemical that has excellent toxicological profile. It's much safer. And all this bill is asking us is for our children's toys, for children under the age of 3, that we make sure that when people go to the store, and I would not be able to tell on the shelf if somebody hadn't told me, which one of these is safe? Which one of these is safe? Which one can I buy? And what happened in Europe, when they banned these products, the toy industry actually outperformed significantly our toy industry in this country. So this is not going to be harmful to our industries. This is going to be a protective element for the most vulnerable children or people in our population. And that's what I came here to do.
Senator Skoy.
Well, Madam Chair, just real briefly, I mean, you hold the two ducks and you hold the two bottles, but we've got such conflicting testimony as to whether one is an impact or not and whether the one is a more or less harmful alternative or not. It doesn't appear to me that we know if one or the other is better, and that's the crux of the problem.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, you're absolutely right, but the public doesn't know which is safe. And I guess the way I would like to word my proposal to you folks is, knowing what we know about the synthetic estrogens, my question is, do we want to put them in baby bottles? That's all. Do we want parents and the grandparents to go to the store and not know what they can buy for their children? They're not scientists. When the science comes out, my guess is we will find a lot more safer chemicals on the market for the interim. For the interim, for the children right now, I think it is wise for us to put on this protective measure. The PCA report also confirms our science.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I don't know what the committee is going to do. It is difficult when you have dueling scientific evidence, but I'd suggest I'd rather see us err on the side of being safe rather than sorry. I'm of a generation that grew up inhaling DDT and all kinds of other chemicals, breathing, eating, heaven knows. Look at the obituaries today. Look at the people in their 50s dying of cancer. I've had two primary cancers myself. One is undoubtedly estrogen-related. I think we have seen, I don't care if it's the movie Aaron Brockovich, nuclear scientists. I remember on our new TV watching nuclear blast tests in Nevada. And, watching them on television. I don't know if how many people in this room are old enough to have done that, but we did. I used to hide behind the couch to do that. And that people knew intuitively that there was something wrong going on, that we were doing things that were going to that could harm us down the road. But the scientists didn't stop us, and they didn't stop themselves, and they kept pushing the envelope until finally we are so bombarded with chemicals, so many preservatives in the food we eat. It's just scary out there. And if you can keep a few products safe, at least the ones that babies keep in their mouth, then why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we err on the side of being safe? And so I strongly support what Senator Rummel's doing here. I understand it may cause some disruption in the market. It sounds like California is doing something. The world can adjust if California can do it, whether it's with CAFE standards or with phthalates, bisphenol A, we can do it too, and I think we should.
So if you could clarify, Senator Rummel, we've talked about that you said that these products have been banned. Have both chemicals been banned, both the phthalates and the BPA? Because I'm confused. I've heard some different information there, and I'm not sure what is quite accurate.
You're absolutely right, Madam Chair. California has banned the phthalates, and so has the European Union. To my knowledge, no one has yet banned bisphenol A. There are 11 states and Canada that are working on that. It's probably going to happen sooner or later.
So we would be the first in the world to ban the BPA, the bisphenol A. Correct.
Products used for children under the age of three. And I don't, the issue isn't who's first, second, or third. This isn't a horse race.
I understand that. I just wanted to clarify because there were some statements of these products have been banned.
And it's very confusing when we use the plural.
And, you know, our time, I'm going to check with staff here. I do think we have one more person to testify. We've given both sides, I think, very extensive time to discuss this. If there's some additional information, but we do need to look at our time. And Senator Michelle, you had a question?
More of a comment, Madam Chair, but if you're trying to move traffic around here, I'll hold off, whatever you'd prefer.
Okay, I'm going to check. It's our time.
I'm curious.
What are we going to do here? Okay, we have about 5 minutes. So, Senator Michelle, did you have a comment?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I guess somewhat in response to Senator Scheid, who I often agree with, but not always.
However.
But not always. You know, I Senator Scheid knows this. I have four daughters under the age of 12, and in thinking about this legislation and listening to more of the testimony today, you know, if I was convinced that something or someone was harmful to them, I would want to do all I could. I would want to do all I could as a state policymaker to make it safer. I think we have a battle of almost mind-numbing numbers and statistics here. But taking one step back from that, if I was convinced that something was hurting my girls, in this area, I would go to the federal government. I would go there today. I would go to the FDA. I would go to the EPA. I would go to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. These chemicals, these products, they don't know state borders. I just don't believe there's a lot Minnesota can do. I don't think we've been convinced that there's something Minnesota should do in this case. And, yeah, I mean, we've absolutely been reminded again today that we are not, as Senator Scoy suggests, we're not scientists. We don't have chemistry backgrounds, biology. You know, if the State Department of Agriculture, the State Department of Health was in front of us, that might be a little more convincing from a Minnesota standpoint. You know, what are our experts saying? But I don't hear that today.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
First of all, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency just completed a study January 2008 in which it listed both bisphenol A and phthalates as endocrine disruptors. In their study, they suggested that the amount of money we spend cleaning these things out of our landfills, that it is far more cost-effective for us to reduce the amount of chemicals we put into our environment. But as far as being a parent of daughters, these are estrogen imitators. And those of us who are women, the longer we live, the more the higher our exposure to estrogen and estrogen imitators, I don't know what the right word is anymore, increases our chance of getting breast cancer. So in a recent study across 11 different countries, women, and I'm going to pick on Senator Scheid because she picks on me and myself, that are grandmother age, have approximately 63 different chemicals in our bodies. The next highest number were in children between the ages of 12 and 20. The body burden of chemicals from our environment is increasing. These are young children who have 53 plus or minus chemicals in their body, and they've only lived as third of their life as I have, or as third as many years. We have to consider what we are doing to our environment. We have to consider the exposure to estrogen-imitating chemicals that we are putting out there. This bill is a small step to protect the youngest in our population.
All right, we are running out of time. Is there any more discussion?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid?
Yeah.
Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, I've submitted an amendment which might be able to get us out of this box.
Do you want to describe that amendment so we make sure we have the right one, Senator Latz?
Sure. Well, the purpose of the amendment is to have a study on the BPA portion of the bill rather than a ban on the BPA portion of the bill. So I don't know if the amendment is in the precise form that council would require it to be, but if we were to leave. It sounds like, you know, California's already made a move in the phthalates area. So all of these companies are going to have to comply with that if they want to stay in that market. But it sounds like a lot of the scientific disagreement, especially, is in the BPA portion. What I'd ask the committee to consider doing is it would be Section 2 of the second engrossment, which is the section that bans bisphenol A, to replace it with a study by the Minnesota, the appropriate agency in Minnesota, to report back by December of 2008, so we'll have ample opportunity to consider whatever the results of the study are in the next legislative session about the impact of BPA, and in particular to do a review of the literature and see if we can get some sense of whether there really is scientific consensus on this, resolve the battle of the scientists, if you will. Give us some guidance from our own professionals employed in state government whose job it is to look at this stuff. Maybe we'll have a better comfort level trying to make some decisions on that next year.
Okay, Senator Lance, we're working on that. Would you also then be
We would be looking at language on line 2.14 and also 2.25 that has references to bisphenol A. And then we would also need to fix the title on line 1.3. So if I could just ask if you're in, yes, Senator Latz.
Senator Skoy here has shown me an amendment which was drafted in a more sophisticated form than mine was, which appears to attempt to accomplish the same thing. I don't know if Senator Rummel has seen the amendment or not. If its goal is to accomplish the same thing, then I would be happy with that. It makes some adjustments in the – does it change the definitions section at all? You know?
Is it drafted to the engrossment?
I don't know if this is drafted to the – it's not drafted to the engrossment. I'll just leave the amendment as I've offered it, Madam Chair.
Okay. So, Senator Latz, I believe we're looking at that amendment right now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Carlson.
While the council is looking at the amendment, I guess one of the things I'd like to say to Senator Skoy is that there is some information here that shows that the study outcomes done by the government showing harm are about 10 to 1, showing harm and showing no harm, and the ones done by the chemical corporations show 0 to 13, where they say it's no harm. So, in fact, I don't think you're going to ever get down to where the manufacturer and the people that hold the intellectual property and the people that are actually using this product ever saying that it's not safe. So you're never going to get to that point. But what I rely on, I guess, is one of the manufacturers of toys, Mattel, has already replaced it. So there is some... There is one of the manufacturers that has stepped up to the plate and has replaced it, and I think others could too.
Okay, Senator Latz, we are working on your amendment. I believe we're just trying to it's ready to go. And Mr. Fuller, could you read that amendment to us?
Madam Chair, members, I believe on page 2 we would delete lines 2, we can leave the head note. Let's delete all of section 2, put in a new section 2 and call it bisphenol A study. And it's pretty much Senator Latz's amendment stylistically. The commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency shall review the scientific literature report and make recommendations to the legislature by December 2nd, was that December 2nd, 2008, on the health impact of bisphenol A's. It reads the same all the way down to bottle, and you strike everything after bottle on the 1, 2, 3, 4th line because it's the report date is up there. And then it say the last sentence, the review shall also study and make recommendations as to the least harmful alternatives to bisphenol A.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. We've just been advised that that study should be directed to the Department of Health.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
I offer that amendment to the
Okay. So it's my understanding that this amendment
And then, Madam Chair, we would take out, I think, bisphenol A on line 14. I think you might be able to keep it on line 25 because it's about a clearinghouse. I don't know if that's related to the ban or not. It's not clear to me. I'll look for Senator Latz for
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, I would leave it in the clearinghouse provision. I think it's helpful to have that knowledge, okay. Which is all that provision.
So we would Madam Chair, we just delete it on line diphenyl A or on line 2.14.
Okay, and that this, Senator Latz?
Madam Chair, I don't see any problem with leaving that phrase biphenyl A in line 14 either, since in the event that they voluntarily were to replace biphenyl A, we'd want them to do it with something that's not a known human carcinogen or a
But it does talk about like the prohibitions, which are not as a result of prohibitions because we're not prohibiting it.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And
okay.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Fuller?
This is a technical, I guess I would ask you to instruct the Secretary to remove the references to the deleted section in the bill and make any coordinating provisions, because we did take out 173, which I see on line 2.15. Okay. We would take it out wherever else it appeared, but that's a clerical thing that we can take care of.
Okay. So on the last amendment, which calls for a study of biphenyl A by the Department of Health and appropriate substitutions that would not cause harm, is that correct? Is that a good summary of the LATS amendment? And then to strike biphenyl A on line 2.14 and to change the title and make other corrections as noted. Is there any further discussion on that amendment? Senator Day.
We have, I don't know, a great amount of wisdom in our Senate, and it's always been wonderful to work here, and I love the idea that we have so many knowledgeable people, but this is an issue that shouldn't be here, friends. This is a federal issue. This is, we have people testifying from the University of Missouri out of Columbia, testifying against somebody that's at the Columbia University in New York. And we're going to do a study in Minnesota. And as far as, and I agree with Senator Scheid, except that you all know and I know, we're all living longer. Our kids are living longer. We're doing a pretty good job in the United States of America and our quality of life and what we do on issues like this. And it seems like if this is a big issue, let the people that are working on it go and work on it. But for us to throw this into one of our health department, we got a lot of other things to do. And this is going to be costly, and it's going to be time-consuming. And I will tell you that we'll have the same dialogue and the same debate a year from now with both sides lined up. So I see no reason to be doing this. So that's and Senator Latz, I know that people here are trying to do the right thing, but mm-hmm. we are wading into real deep water.
Okay. Other discussion, Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, if the amendment goes on, does that require the bill then to go to finance?
I would assume that we have not had testimony on if there is a cost to this or not. Is the health department able to respond to that? Would there be a cost to implementing this study? Mr. John Linkstein is here.
Madam Chair, John Stein, the Director of Environmental Health at the health department. It will depend upon the scope of the study.
Which we have not outlined in this.
We have not outlined. So I'll assume that we'll do a fairly comprehensive review of the existing literature, which the time frame that's been discussed and the cost would be rather difficult to attain, because my understanding is there's a significant volume of research on this subject.
Okay, so that is sort of, you're not quite sure if there's a fiscal note or not. And I appreciate that, Mister. I appreciate that very
much.
I'm
sure that's correct, although
I would
expect there will be a fiscal note on this.
There will be a fiscal note, so this would be referred to finance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
In response to Senator Bach's question and the testifier's comments, I simply wish to reiterate what Chairman Mensah has often said, which is sometimes we should be able to send stuff to the department and have them do it with existing staff, not attach a dollar amount to it.
All Senator right. Rosen. Madam Chair. And then we will be moving very quickly here. Senator Rest is giving, yes.
Madam Chair, I'm just going to state I'm just a little disgruntled by this whole process, and we should have been done a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And this is a very serious bill with serious ramifications to it. And that's all I'm going to say right now.
Okay. We're ready to vote on the LATS amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And the motion does not prevail. All right, Senator Rummel, what would you like to do with the bill? Move this forward with one vote. All right. is, has anyone moved the bill?
Madam Chair, I will.
So Senator Scheid has moved 1858 as it was in the second engrossment. Is there any more discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, if I may. We talk about asking the federal government to look into this. You know, I think they dropped the ball badly on toy safety at the federal level. I think they've dropped the ball terribly in terms of health issues. I think it's really up to us to take a stand and say we opt for safety. We'd rather be safe than sorry. And so I hope that members will think about that, because we'll always have conflicting science.
Okay.
I would appreciate.
So we need to vote, and I appreciate all those comments. Okay. On Senate File 1858, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
And the motion does not prevail. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
That's okay.
Very nice.
Oh, my God. You know, I'd give anything. I'm trying to get to 66.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
You know,
close.
You'll get there.
I mean,
you
know, there's no question. I mean, one of my cancers.
20 years ago, you'd been dead.
That's true. That's true. With the second one. No, with both of the cancers I've had.